home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson. And tonight we've got, as usual, an exciting show for you. Tonight we are centering around resources for LGBT people, particularly one in particular that is about to launch, called Pride Pocket. And this is, well, we'll let the founder of it tell us more about it when she comes on. But the idea is to have one source that LGBT people can go to, I think, help raise money and have different resources. And sounds like a really exciting endeavor. And we're excited to talk to her about it, find out what is going on with it and what the prospects are. On deck on our expert journalist panel, we have, as always, the renowned Karen Oakham and Brody Levesque. I'm going to bring them on right now. We've had kind of a exciting new year. Welcome, folks. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
2018
Hi.
Version. Hi. So, guys, what's been going on? The last few days has been like implosion, explosion in Washington. Jeff Sessions did some stuff, Karen, that will affect us here in California and the new legalized pot initiative. So, guys, before we bring our guests, I wanted to just check in with your expert journalist stuff. And what are you guys working on? What stories are hot?
Oh, where do we start? Well, I think the Jeff Sessions thing, we're kind of keeping more of an eye on it than actually freaking out because, you know, Jeff Sessions is a states' rights guy, you know, 10th Amendment guy. And he's also, you know, he also thinks that pot is morally evil. So I'm not sure that this memo that he issued is actually going to, have any effect here in California or Washington or you know, any of these other states. I mean, there are a number of attorney generals and mayors and governors who are saying, well, wait a second, it's not only legal here, but it's big business, and we're not particularly cottoning to this threat from the federal government, besides which, scheduling marijuana as if it's the same as heroin is not fair, especially because it's not, number one. And number two, you have an opioid crisis where we're talking about real heroin and real fentanyl and real deaths. So there's a real pushback happening, and the memo itself actually basically says that federal prosecutors can go ahead with prosecutions. I don't know how they're going to marshal their resources and get FBI raids on, you know, cannabis clubs all over the place. It's going to be very interesting. I'm not sure that he wasn't sort of muscled into it and issued the memo to be on Trump's good side, since he's really not on Trump's good side at all, and try to rescue his reputation. That's number one. Number two, the Golden Globes are happening this Sunday.
Well,
and
before you move to the
Golden
Globes, Karen, hold on, because I want to ask you a follow-up question before you go to the Golden Globes. I want to ask you before we move off the pot issue. The LA Times covered the four different federal prosecutors in the state of California and got kind of feedback on the Jeff Sessions thing. To your point, that you know everybody's kind of doing a wait and see type thing. I wanted to ask you if you had any sense of those four. The three, Sacramento, San Francisco, and L.A., all seemed pretty nonplussed. I mean, none of them sounded like they were going to do a thing about it. The fourth one out of San Diego sounded like they could be revving up. And I wanted to just see if, you know, you've got your finger on the pulse. Do you have any sense of that San Diego office, like they might go a little renegade on it?
I do not have a sense of that, but I can tell you that San Diego, of the four you've mentioned, is the more conservative. One would think Sacramento, but actually San Diego is pretty conservative. But bear in mind that it's a Republican. There are a lot of Republicans in that area who are up for re-election. And even though we're now talking about recreational use of marijuana, it's going to be tied to medical marijuana. And any sort of taking away, I mean, you've got Obamacare, you've got the mandate, you've got all this stuff on people's minds now, fearful about what's going to be happening with their health care. And medical marijuana is kind of a settled issue. So this is going to be looked at interference from the federal government in a local state issue that's already settled. And I'm not sure that the Republicans, frankly, the congressional Republicans in that area, including Daryl Issa, would favor something like that. So we've already started seeing some Republicans coming out saying, hold off. We have the one Republican from Colorado saying, a senator, saying he's going to hold up any Senate judicial confirmation hearings if Jeff Sessions goes forward with this. So it would have some major ramifications. I don't know that federal offices do things in a renegade way, albeit, you know, this new book suggests that maybe they do. But, you know, it sounds all like a yeah. role, you know. So,
right.
But anyway, so also, I don't know. I would say everybody is on treading on eggs right now because nobody knows what the hell is going on. So I'm not sure that they would be a renegade. They'd probably, and the attorney general here. Becerra would just freak. So
Right.
Well, for all those reasons, I think that, we don't necessarily have to freak out totally yet.
Yeah. Well, the Orange County Republican congressman who, his name is escaping me right now, but he had a quote saying that Jeff Sessions was becoming the best friend of the illegal drug cartels by rolling this out. So, yeah, the Republican rhetoric on his side is definitely not in support of what he's doing.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing is that when you have oversight and regulation such as has happened now, you don't have the black market. You know, you dry up the black market. And that, you know, for no other reason, and this is what happened with medical marijuana, you know, speaks to the safety issue. And again, when you have people keeling over from the opioid crisis, we have all sorts of safety issues. And you just don't want to have to go back to the old days of getting pot that's mixed with what? Who knows what?
Right.
And having cancer and AIDS patients smoking that, doing a doobie or, you know, a brownie or something like that and keeling over because it's not safe pot.
Right.
Golden
so, Karen, you were going to the Golden Globes. Golden Globes. Let's do the Globes.
Okay, very quickly, so we can get on to Brody, who I'm sure is going to be talking about this the revelations of this new book. But Golden Globes. We have, it seems, and we'll see more what is going to actually happen, but it really, really, really seems like we're at a tipping point with this whole sexual harassment thing and the Me Too movement. I've gotten calls, I have to tell you, because of the way I've been writing about the sexual harassment issue. I've gotten calls from gay men who are happy about the Me Too movement because they have not been able to talk about the sexual harassment that they've experienced because it's just assumed to be part of gay liberation. And, you know, so what happens at the Golden Globes will be very interesting. The women, as you know, a number of rich Hollywood women have pulled together an initiative that will be led by Anita Hill. That's quite separate. But at the Golden Globes, they're, right now, a lot of the actresses will be wearing black as a political statement about sexual harassment. We'll probably hear comments from the stage. I don't know if anybody's going to mention Harvey Weinstein or Kevin Spacey by name, but, you know, some of the movies, including the Kevin Spacey movie that he got kicked out of, are up, you know, are nominated. So it should be very interesting. It should be a time unlike any other for political speeches, if you will. We've had a couple, you know, regarding AIDS, of course. We had a couple following 9/11, you know, and Osama bin Laden. But I think that this is going to be kind of a, I think people are going to try to be clever in their scolding of Hollywood and scolding of male privilege, if you will. And it'll be very interesting because the action about sexual harassment will wind up being equal pay for women and having women be in senior management and senior production in studios. So we'll see, but I think we're at a historical tipping point here. And that's
I
it for me for the Golden Globes.
Well, no, I think you brought an interesting point, though, because I've just noticed that in a lot of places, the ascension of people into influential positions have been more women. I mean, it really, you know, it really will be an interesting byproduct if, you know, a lot of the glass ceiling actually gets broken inadvertently by going after the sexual harassment. So huge positive on that.
Yeah, it's no
Brody.
Longer okay, you know, for men to just, you know, plant these wet kisses or grab your boob or, you know, pat your butt or, you know, and then for women are starting to see that the economics of consent, you know, you don't have to go along with that just to save your job. And by the way, it's not just in the entertainment community. It's starting to, if you will, trickle down and expand into other industries, including, you know, housekeepers, for heaven's sake. You think that those male producers only call in, you know, attractive starlets? No, they, you know, they go after housekeepers. And oftentimes, especially in L.A., they're undocumented and they'll get raped or they'll even get trafficked and nobody says anything. So,
no,
you know, it is a major turning point.
Yeah, that was an issue in the Schwarzenegger, not necessarily rape, but his housekeeper actually had his illegitimate son. So, you know, that's the only one that was visible. So,
yes, but
reasons.
I think she wound up getting her citizenship. I mean, I don't think that she could have been his housekeeper without having citizenship. Remember
right.
that?
No,
you know,
no, my
that
point was,
that's been
yeah,
a very big
was,
issue, yeah.
Yeah, my point was it was a person of power with a subordinate in his household.
Yes.
Yeah.
But imagine
yeah.
hotels.
Yeah.
You know, and,
oh, yeah.
and we've
no.
seen the
yeah.
decimation of unions. So it's not as if undocumented housekeepers could even go to a union and say, you know, and who's running the unions to say, well, you know, so-and-so raped me and I need help. And they'll go, well, I don't know exactly what to tell you. You can't go to the HR department. They'll say, you want the job
right.
or not? Shut up.
Right.
We need this guy
right.
to keep coming back. That's the
right.
economics
right.
of consent.
Yep. So good changes there. Brody, what's going on in Washington?
Well, before we get started on Washington and all of its finery and nonsense, I wanted to take a note real briefly and let our listeners know that last week we lost a very outstanding scientist and a neuroscientist to pancreatic cancer, and this was brought to my attention by young Jack Andreka, who's been working on a cure for pancreatic cancer. Dr. Ben Barnes was on the faculty and staff at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. He was an amazing individual. His work on doing a lot of scientific things that I'm not even going to go because that's way beyond my pay grade and comprehension since I'm a political reporter. But the doctor was instrumental in reformulating some of the ideas, particularly as a scientist when it came down to the transgender community. Dr. Barnes was actually transgender himself. He had transitioned actually kind of late in life at the age of 43 in 1997. He was an MIT undergraduate as a doctoral candidate. He was an amazing person, and so I just wanted to note what I consider to be an unfortunate passage, not only for the LGBTQI community, but for the world in general. As an openly transgender scientist, Dr. Barnes was the first ever to be elected to the National Academy of Sciences, and Dr. Barnes really kind of acted as a role model, particularly for, as Jack pointed out to me, anyone that was looking towards working in STEM and also be trans at the same time. So regrettably, we lost a great man last week. All right, let's talk about Washington. Okay, Michael Wolff's book, Fire and the Fury, was supposed to be released next Tuesday, and after a considerable amount of noise in the last 48 hours from the White House, the Henry Holt Publishing House is going to release it tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I got my e-copy, reviewer's copy, about 7 hours ago. I've had a chance to go through it. This book is going to make all of Washington extremely nervous very quickly, and I've already heard from White House sources today that the ceiling is coming off of the White House. So this is a thing. In terms of significance and damage to the Trump administration, I'd say it's up for grabs. I think what's more important to note is that some of the things that Michael covered in the book parallel some of the things that we've been hearing from Director Mueller's investigation, and we're also hearing from other sources. I think the most interesting revelation that did come out of the book was the fact that Trump and his wife truly, honestly, did not expect to get elected president of the United States. And it caught them very flat-footed. And what ended up happening is what we've seen for the better part of the last year, and that is what could loosely be termed an ad hoc presidency. You have someone who was ill-prepared for this kind of job. You have someone who, quite frankly, has other issues in addition to being narcissistic. And then you have a polarized pulling between Capitol Hill and the White House, only from the standpoint that the Republicans saw Trump and this administration as the goose that laid the golden egg, because they now get to push through their agenda, because this guy literally has proved that he'll sign anything if they convince him that it's a good idea, and more importantly, it was his idea. And by rolling back, I'm not talking about the Obama administration. This goes back to Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, Medicare and Medicaid, the Supplemental Nutritional Program, the Food Stamp Program. It goes into the New Deal. It goes into the New Frontier. It actually takes away from the Nixon administration on the environmental protections that were put into play. So this is definitely an all-the-way across conservative onslaught and rollback. And Trump has been their golden goose. Whether or not the book is going to get Washington in such a position that it's going to pay attention and make things obvious is highly questionable. I'm not sure. There are a lot of things in the book that they're drama-filled and they're really nice, but at the end of the day, I'm not sure whether or not they're really going to be all that effective. I think we really do need to sit this one out. We need to see what Mueller's going to come up with. There are cases that Michael Wolff makes in the book that would probably look at obstruction of justice, because there are some statements in there. Now, keep in mind, too, Mr. Wolff not only documented everything that he was doing, but he also tape recorded these conversations, and he did his due diligence. So, you know, there's a lot of back and forth on this. But that's got Washington in an uproar. So at this point, everything else is kind of muted by, you know, the comings and goings. We're our first week back. We have a snowstorm all up and down the East Coast. Trump didn't even wait for the corpse of 2017 to go cold before he started threatening people and war on Twitter. Everybody, of course, has been talking about the my button is bigger than your button. And then, of course, he attacked Pakistan earlier today, which was not really all that constructive. So, anyway, that's kind of the comings and goings from Washington.
Brody,
right,
I have a question.
Yeah,
one of the things that just kind of occurred to me as I've been watching, you know, I have CNN or MSNBC or sometimes even Fox on the background all the time as I do my work. And one of the things that struck me is how drawn I have been to the dissection of not only this book, but the Russia investigation and how people are responding to it, et cetera. And something really struck me. It's like I remember the Watergate hearings. I remember that summer moving, you know, I was a kid. I was home from college during summer or whatever, and I remember moving the television in such a way that I could still sit outside and get a suntan while watching the Watergate hearings during my summer vacation. I think that people are riveted to this or are becoming riveted to this because of Trump's peculiar behavior. It's almost like, remember the OJ trial? I mean, regardless of how people reacted at the end, there was a civics lesson that was happening with, you know, it was a cross between a soap opera and a civics lesson. And I think with the odd, salacious parts of this book that, you know, that mixed with news popping out, even on Fox, about how strange this guy's behavior is, this guy being the president of the United States, that even Trump voters are starting to, like, seriously tune in and are getting not only tired of him, but kind of riveted and drawn into the story. And I'm wondering if you're getting that kind of same sensibility, that people are starting to get hooked on this as a story.
Yeah, I think they are. And I've been talking to colleagues all day long, and I've been comparing notes. And I think that, yeah, there is that sense of that. The problem with the Trump base and the Trump supporters is that so far they've been able to give him a pass. It depends upon how nuts gets in terms of how much more of a pass they're going to give him. There are people who have been called before Congress to talk about, you know, his mental state. And I've heard from a couple of sources that one rather prominent psychiatrist indicated that if he had to run a diagnosis of Trump, he would say without fail early onset Alzheimer's. And that in and of itself is something that should probably alarm lawmakers on the Hill. I guess the question really becomes is what's going to be the tipping point for Capitol Hill? And quite frankly, the Washington Press Corps, myself, even though I'm no longer there, and quite a few others, we're not seeing it yet. We think that the Republicans are nudging towards that, but we really don't think that they're ready to go there yet. And what I think this book will do, if nothing else, is that it brings into rather specific relief and sharp clarity just how much of a train wreck this White House really is. Rob?
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Brody, and Karen, you too, to some extent, but Brody, you probably have more insight onto this. So Trump has been very vocally anti-media, although it's been sort of like a Sarah Palin love-hate, you know, I hate you, by the way, cover me, cover me. Why did this guy get such unfettered access to the Trump administration? I mean, were they thinking this was going to be a love fest book? What was the rationale behind the access?
I would agree with Karen. Well, it really is a one syllable answer. Yes, I think that, keep in mind that Trump has always had handlers. And this is something that's really important for listeners to understand. This president has always had handlers. He's always had a buffer. The Trump Organization was operated principally by his children, and they were the buffers. So he could get away with whatever he wanted, because at the end of the day, Ivanka, Don Jr., and Eric would pick up the slack and run with the ball. When you move into the political spectrum and you move into the presidency of the United States, this is completely different, because ultimate decisions, you know, they stop on one desk and one desk only. And that wasn't necessarily true of the Trump administration of his company, because he was able to mitigate or had mitigated some of his more egregious actions by his children. It was very difficult for Reince Priebus, the first chief of staff, and even this White House chief of staff, to do that. And the other part of it, too, I think, was that, and we've heard Press Secretary Huckabee Sanders say this, is this president likes to communicate directly. What you're not hearing her say is that every time he does so, okay, the immediate reaction of the White House staff, particularly those in the West Wing, is to have a stroke or a heart attack wondering what he said now. So I think that they saw this book and having this person write this book as a way to mitigate some of the more, what they felt was egregious criticisms coming from what they've termed, or the president has at least termed, fake news media. I really believe that they saw this as damage control and to paint a rosy picture. I don't think they anticipated the fact that this was going to be an honest portrayal of this administration, warts and all. And that's really why I think it happened.
Well, and also, okay, Michael Wolff had already written a glowing piece about him earlier. So they thought that it was going to be just basically an expansion of that. He has a reputation of having, you know, sort of cozied up to people and seduced them. And then, you know, I think it was Rupert Murdoch he did exactly the same thing to. One of the things that is sort of like this, you know, gap that nobody's spoken about, but I think needs to be filled, is that there's a tantalizing little thing about why did that bodyguard get fired? You know, the guy who had been so close to him for so long. And part of me, and maybe this is just me as a suspicious woman, but I just, you know, this is a president who measures his penis, for God's sake, and during a debate, a presidential debate. And I'm wondering if part of this that is not spoken in the book and why the bodyguard got fired is kind of Trump pulling a JFK. You know, Melania sleeps in a separate bedroom. There's a part in the book about how, you know, Trump retires early at 6:30 and eats his cheeseburgers and talks to all these friends. But I'm suspicious. I wonder if, quote unquote, girls, because he talks about girls, aren't being brought in surreptitiously, and he's not, you know, feeding on Viagra. And, you know, because that is so much part of his makeup from New York to now, to the, you know, the Hollywood extra Access Hollywood tape, that is not being addressed. And I think that there's some stuff in the background
extra.
There.
Access Hollywood.
Hang on. I'm getting a feed through from my browser, so you guys got to interrupt. Sorry about that, Karen.
Yeah, no,
that's okay.
Yeah, I said, and there's Access Hollywood calling in.
Yeah, interrupted by myself. That's interesting.
Yeah, that was perfect timing. So, guys.
I just wanted to throw that out there because, if something like that pops, then, I think Trump's done with.
I do too.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to our guest.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to call stop on both you guys right now. We're at the half hour mark, and our guest has been extremely patient while we've covered Hollywood to Washington and all the juicy gossip in between. But right now, I'd like to bring her on, Rachel Blank. Thank you for joining us, and we are excited to hear about Pride Pocket. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing great.
And you can tell we are a lively crew here. So so tell us about Pride Pocket.
Yeah. Well, sort of is that Pride Pocket is a one-stop shop, I guess you would say, for the LGBTQ community to find any and all resources that they would need to kind of navigate through certain situations they might find themselves in, and giving them an outlet to do something about it. So what I mean by that is we have an educational aspect of it where you can read articles about anything from transitioning, family planning, what do I do in these situations? And then we go as far as we've built a crowdfunding platform that you can actually crowdfund for these situations. And unlike the other ones out there, keep every single penny.
That sounds super exciting. Now, I understand the launch of this is coming mid-month January. Is that correct?
That's correct. We are doing a beta launch in mid-January. We have a beta sign-up list, and several people have signed up, and they're going to get to try it out. And within the next month or so, we'll get some feedback from them, add on some more features that we've been building out, and release it to the public for everybody to use and enjoy.
So where did this come from? Where did the idea for the site come from? How was the baby birthed?
Yeah, it is my baby. So I grew up in Orlando, and the first club that I ever went to, a gay club, was Pulse. And so when I heard what happened at Pulse nightclub, my gut reaction was just shock, sadness, and hopelessness. Like, I felt like I had to do something, but I'm living across the country with my fiance and I'm a designer. So what am I going to do? From there, I kind of just thought on, like, what can I actually do for the community? How can I make things better? How can I kind of help the world become a safer place for the community? And so one day I was just having a conversation with my fiance, Courtney, who's also my co-founder. And, we were talking about our future. What was it going to look like? Did we want to have kids? How is it going to work? What was it going to cost us as a lesbian couple? Is it going to be safe to have children in a world like this? And so, we started doing some research and realized there should be a place where, like, we could just go and find all of the answers. We ended up on hundreds of different websites and forums. We didn't know what we could trust. But what we came down to was there's a lot of options out there. It's really complicated. And it was going to cost $40,000 to $60,000 just to try. So from there, my first thought was, why can't this exist? Why doesn't this exist? And, originally our thought was a family planning resource center and crowdfunding platform. So instead of having a wedding registry, you would have a family planning registry where people could donate. And from there, it very quickly turned into what it is now, which is a single platform that offers educational articles and resources for not only family planning, but every topic you can imagine for the LGBTQ community, as well as a crowdfunding platform that not only connects individuals to organizations that they can trust, but gives them a place to raise funds, keep 100% of it, and do it in a private way. So every single feature that we have been building in our platform has the LGBTQ community in mind, with privacy and security.
So when setting up the crowdfunding piece of this, what kind of concerns did you have on the back end in terms of both implementing it so that it's secure and safe, but also so that the you know whoever comes on is actually presenting a real situation. Because as you know, a lot of the crowdfunding things have been scams and that type of thing, which is why people have sort of shied away from them. What have you done to police that or set that up?
It definitely. So, I mean, our first thought when we were creating this was, what if we start getting trolls? And what if they start just posting terrible, hateful things? Because this is an entire platform meant for the LGBTQ community. And so, you know, that's why we came up with our three pillars of security and privacy, one of which is very similar to what's out there. It's, you know, public campaign that you can launch and anybody can find it. And as long as you're okay with that, we're okay with that. The second one is a link-only approach where you can share a link with friends and family and they can share with friends and family and anybody that has that link can see your campaign and donate to it. And the third one is for the people out there that feel very vulnerable or aren't completely out yet and really want this under lock and key. And that's an invite-only approach where the only people that can actually see your campaign, let alone donate to it, are ones that you specifically have invited and have actually accepted the invitation and created an account with us so we can keep them kind of, you know, under our radar. Another thing that we've started to do is that in order to leave any sort of comment on somebody's campaign, you must donate at least a certain amount of money. I'm not going to give that an amount, but, you know, a troll is most likely not going to be willing to fork over actual money just to spew some hateful words. So, you know, every single decision we're making as we build this has stemmed from experiences that we've experienced with crowdfunding platforms or that our friends have told us, you know, you should watch out for this or that. And on top of that, just general security. You know, we want to make sure that we're moving money here. We want to make sure that it's done in a way that is trustworthy, that your information won't be hacked. And it's taken a lot of research and, you know, senior developers to kind of put together the infrastructure for that.
Yeah, I bet. Brody, you had a question?
Yeah, and Rachel, good evening. It's good to talk with you again. I will have to confess that she and I have had several conversations prior to the show. Rachel, talk to me a little bit about what's going on in the thinking process. What makes this different than GoFundMe or Kickstarter? And more importantly, like you and I discussed off the air, what makes this so unique that is going to be so attractive, particularly to the transgender, queer, and gender non-binary members of the community? Because as you know, as we've discussed, transitioning has a lot of considerations that many people don't understand. We talked about binders. We've talked about electrolysis for, you know, the male to female for removing hair. We've talked about hormonal treatments and things like that. And we're talking about, you know, insurance companies that aren't picking up tabs and things that aren't happening and the whole thing with that. So what, give me again and give Rob and Karen kind of an idea of why this is so different and why this is unique. Go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so first and foremost, in my experience, there's nothing worse than getting into a situation where you feel so desperate that you ask friends and family for money and then finding out that the platform you're using is just going to kind of profit off of that. And so one of the first pillars of what makes us, you know, special and unique is we will never take a single penny from the campaign host. So if you are in need and you are raising funds, you keep 100% of that. There's no platform fee. The transaction fee, which has to be paid by someone, is at the moment going to be paid for by the person donating. But that's it. You know, there's no hidden fees. It's all for helping people actually achieve what they need. The second part that I think is really important is that not only are we offering the privacy settings that none of the other platforms out there offer, but on top of that, you know, we're partnering this with all the educational aspects. So, you know, let's say somebody's just realized that they identify as being trans. They can go in, find some information out, you know, link up to a doctor, a psychiatrist, find out everything that they need to do, start planning for it. And then when they're finally ready, they can start a campaign and say, hey, guys, I'm finally out as trans, and I'm going to start hormonal therapy. As you all know, I don't have the support of my family, and so I'm asking anyone that is able to donate to getting hormones, right? So maybe they reach their goal there to get them to a place where they can start their treatment. Maybe a few months down the line, they start researching options for surgery or electrolysis, anything else, and they can continue to use this platform for any situation they might find themselves in. You know, and they might use it for something down the road that's completely unrelated to their own situation. It could be, hey, guys, I want to give back, so I've started my own nonprofit, and I'm going to be donating money to individuals that identify as trans and don't have the support of their families, might be homeless, and might have other issues. And so this platform can just kind of keep growing on itself. It can be used for multiple reasons, and it kind of goes in circles. You have a situation, you learn about it, you raise money, and pass it on to the next person.
I think the only follow-up question I would have to that is, and before Karen jumps in, there's one thing that's really kind of critically important here, and this discussion came up numerous times, and that is the authenticity of the person and the requesting. We're not talking about trolls here. You know, what safeguards are in place? Because at some point you're going to have to actually identify these people. So what sort of process will you be using for authentication, verification, and that sort of thing? I mean, even Facebook's gotten to the point now where it wants, you know, some form of, you know, either use your real name, or if you're, forbid, a celebrity, they want, you know, everything except the kitchen sink. What steps have you guys taken for that? And I'm going to throw it to Karen, okay?
Yeah, so, I mean, from the moment that you sign up for an account, not only are our terms of service going to be very, very strict about what these campaigns can be used for, obviously nothing can be anti-LGBTQ, hateful, illegal, anything of that sort, but also we're a very small team, but we plan to monitor the first incoming campaigns to start learning what people want to use this for, but also how they're using it. And, you know, if anything seems out of line, or if anything seems like it might be in some way a scam or not authentic, we have every ability to pause a campaign, reach out to the person, you know, get them on a call and make sure that it's legitimate. You know, we'd rather be safe than sorry right now, but at the same time, we do want to offer people the ability to, you know, have the privacy. We don't want to out them or force them to use their legal name other than the purpose of moving the money, you know, in that case, whatever's on their bank account is what they would need to provide to us to move the money. But yeah, we're going to be monitoring this very closely at the beta stages. And as we build out and grow, we're going to use machine learning and any other ways to kind of track how this is being used, any sort of strange behavior, and make sure that, you know, nothing fishy is going on.
Okay. Thank you, Karen.
Yeah. Karen.
Yeah, my turn. Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm great. It's nice to meet you.
You too. And I'm looking at your website, and I'm very impressed by this about page where there are photos of you and Courtney and Mark and your other, I presume your other team. Team members, but they're not identified. There's no, so I really like the grassroots effort of this. I think that, you know, your idea and, you know, your gumption to put it together and go forward is really terrific, but I'm not seeing kind of basic information like, where are you guys? I mean, it wasn't until I clicked onto your photo and it took me to your LinkedIn page to say that you're from the Bay Area, you know, for instance. I didn't see anywhere on your website where it says, based in such and such a place, here's our headquarters address, here's our contact information. You know, that kind of solid information that kind of grounds you in authenticity, if you will. So that's a question. You know, I'm missing kind of some of that information, number one. And maybe it's just that I deal with these kinds of websites all the time. You know, the National Organization for Marriage, for instance, or, you know, Lord knows all of these. You know, they buy images of people and they put them on a nice-sounding website, and they're asking for money for a good cause, but, you know, they're not weighted down in authenticity. So I'm kind of missing that, other than I think linking to your LinkedIn page is a good idea. Secondly, going to Brody's point, I'm a little concerned about sexual harassment, because somebody who is trying to troll an ex would be willing to pay in order to comment. So I'm wondering if you have something along those lines to protect you. Thirdly, how are you guys being funded to do this? I mean, I see that you, senior product designer at Layer. Do you all, the 12 of you, have other jobs that you do, and you're doing this part-time until it gets started? How are you being funded in order to get this off the ground? Because I'm not seeing any sponsored by or connected with, you know, HRC, for instance, or LGBT funders or anything along those lines. And you know, forgive me for all this line of questioning. It's just those are the kinds of things that I look for. So those are three questions off the top.
Yeah, no, definitely a great question. So, yeah, I mean, I'll start out with the background of where we're located. And it's a great question. We are remote. You know, the development team is based out of the Bay Area. That's where myself and my fiance and co-founder Courtney are located. But this has been a passion project that has turned into a reality over the course of the last year. And so, you know, we aren't tied to only people in a specific geography. We have people in DC, Boston, Manhattan. We have people that are passionate about what we're doing and, you know, willing to put in the time to get this done. And kind of to your second point, we do, all of us do have full-time jobs. So this is something that we believe in so strongly that we're working late nights and weekends around the clock to get, you know, all of this together. We are funded right now by myself. So, you know, again, huge passion project that has turned into something that, you know, we all believe in this so much that I've never thought that I'd be the kind of person that would just, you know, put most of my paycheck towards something like this. But, you know, there comes a time when you realize that if you don't do it, then either no one else is going to do it or maybe the wrong people will. And it just had to be done. About the sexual harassment and such, you know, that's a great question. And unfortunately, a lot of times you cannot prevent certain users from doing those things. You know, it's bound to happen no matter what platform you use. But that is why, you know, we have the invite-only aspect of our platform. Mm-hmm. We know that there are a lot of people out there that are either, maybe they're being trolled on the internet just because they're very out there and, you know, for whatever reason, people found them and they're like, oh, this trans person, we are going to post about them everywhere and say terrible things. Maybe those people are more guarded. Maybe it's somebody that isn't completely out. And whatever the case is, you have the option to have an invite-only campaign. And what that means is that absolutely nobody can find your campaign unless you specifically invite them. And, you know, if it becomes an issue where you have a public campaign and you start getting these issues, you can always change the type of campaign. You can always up the privacy and you can always report people to us. And we will be keeping sort of a database of a blacklist of anyone that tries to do anything harmful in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, we definitely have our users' backs. And we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that they feel safe and yeah, secure.
Yeah, that's great. May I suggest that you figure out a way to say all of that and put that on your about page?
Yeah,
because
that's great.
You know, if I'm you know, just a reporter just coming to your page and I'm looking under our story, I mean, I get the emotional part of it, but there's some particulars such as that you just addressed that I think, you know, would be very important, especially in terms of transparency. And even if you don't have a LinkedIn page for the rest of your team, I see you have first names, but you might want to, you know, again, for transparency and people just sort of like believing in the project. Here are 12 people who absolutely believe in the project and are, you know, willing to put their time and sweat equity into this. You
yeah,
might
definitely
want to just, you know, point that kind of stuff out.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate the feedback. I'll definitely get on that.
Yeah. Rachel, I wanted to ask you, the site talks about the resource aspect going away from the crowdfunding, guidebooks, the one-stop shop for information, et cetera. Who are your resources that for medical, for family advice, all of those different issues, who are you tapping into for content on those resource pages?
Yeah, so as you can probably tell, we are, you know, scaling this thing up. You got to start somewhere. And right now we have, I think, 4 writers who have been actively writing and reaching out to sources, no matter what the industry might be. We also have a lot of volunteers who have been connecting us with very reputable people in, you know, Lambda Legal, all of these organizations that we can find information from. And on top of that, you know, a lot of it just comes down to good writers that can do the research and provide the information and cite it so that, you know, everything that we write about, we want to be factual things that you can look up and that you know you can rely on. So we don't want anything biased. It's not a news site. It's not a celebrity gossip site. Everything is going to be fact-based, things that you could find elsewhere on the internet, probably. But it's going to be all in one place and tailored specifically to the community.
Brody, you had a question?
Yeah, I wanted to return for a second and revisit Karen's points because there were a couple that I think really do need to be addressed. I completely understand and I get the remote and the understanding that, you know, you've got a very good team. They're very passionate and very, you know, committed both creatively and otherwise. But Karen's kind of right. If I was to offer a criticism, it's that even Twitter or Amazon have brick and mortar addresses. You know, it's one of the things that is in this age, especially digitally, still a needed thing. And that's something that maybe you and your board should probably consider because it really does have a thing where people don't want to call into question an effort just simply because it doesn't have a mailing address for snail mail that nobody uses anyway, you know, as opposed to email. So that was it, just that statement, Rob.
Yeah, mine is kind of going back to points that we've asked about before, and I apologize up front for, like, beating a dead horse with it. But, Rachel, I'm a little nervous for you in terms of the type of campaigns that are likely to come across. And I come from my background as a writer because Brody and Karen are journalists, and they're out reporting on factual stuff. My writing has been a lot of human interest stuff. I've talked about, told stories of different families and their family situations and things that have happened to people, kind of the life drama type stuff. And what I've come across quite a lot is situations where, like, we had the waitress who made up the harassment on a receipt, where somebody wrote something nasty and it turned out she wrote it herself, and different people beating themselves up literally and then claiming they were gay bashed. And I've also been approached by numerous supposed couples raising money to start families without any verification whatsoever that
the money they were trying to raise was really going to go for that at all. And, you did mention that you were going to watch for anything that seemed bogus or out of line, but it just seems like there's I just know in my experience working with a lot of these situations, the situation isn't obvious. It's a judgment call. You know, it's like because you can't really verify it. Everything may line up, but then many of these have turned out to be false. And I was just wondering what kind of protection you're putting in place, whether how deep you guys are looking into that, because some of these could be pretty life dramatic, both because those are the ones that are going to raise a lot of money, but, whether they're actually telling the truth or not is kind of crucial to ongoing credibility.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And this actually has come up in, conversation. I think part of it comes down to if you're going to be that person, that lies to your friends and family, and part of that is it's on you. Your friends and family are there to help you. And so there's nothing we can do about, people doing terrible things. That being said, we do have plans in the future once we've grown and, got a little bit of funding and can work a little bit more towards this, we'd like to have partnerships with doctors and lawyers and surgeons so that instead of just giving the money to your friend who says that they need it for this one thing, it's going to go directly to the doctor, the lawyer, the whatever it may be, the psychiatrist, so that you know it's going to the right place. It's not going to be mandatory because it's impossible to have all of those connections. But it does give peace of mind in my understanding. I've actually donated to campaigns on things like GoFundMe to friends that, give you the sob story and you feel so bad and you kind of look at your bank account and you're like, I don't really have the money to do this, but I'm going to donate anyway. And then 6 months later, you don't really know what the update is and you kind of reach out and they end up not using it for what they said they would. And it's a terrible feeling.
Right.
But that being said, we can't stop people from doing that, but we can try to to mitigate that risk by offering different ways for people to get funded and for have the money go directly to where they say it will.
Well, we're down to our last 2 minutes here. Rachel, what haven't we asked that we should have that people need to know about Pride Pocket?
You guys have done a pretty good job, I'm not going to lie, giving me a lot to think about. What people can expect from us, as I said, we're a very small team, and we are all literally volunteering our time to do this, and I'm writing my personal finances, so be patient with us, but you'll see a lot of us in the next 2 months. We're going to hopefully have a complete public release of our crowdfunding app, and we're going to be continuing to write articles. So just keep an eye out.
Great. Well, Rachel, I want to thank you so much for being part of the show and best of luck to Pride Pocket. Keep us posted how you're doing. And, obviously we're hoping that one of the links you'll put on there is to Rated LGBT Radio. So people can use us as a news resource. So there's a plug for that. I want to thank Brody and Karen as always for your expertise, insight, and wisdom. That is excellent and fascinating. We have some great shows lined up in the future for Rated LGBT Radio already, so we are kicking off the new year in a very big way. And also listen to Out in Santa Cruz Saturday nights on www.ksco.com. You can live stream that. That is also at 7 p.m., and that's 10 p.m. Pacific time. So for all of us here at Rated LGBT Radio, I want to thank you very much. I hope you all have a good evening, and we will see you next week.